If Parliament is not acting, you will zoom in to act. Bearing in mind the fact that after Klomega in Article 1815, where you give Parliament the chance to enact, to regulate, we are still not done with that. Would you want to take that up, should there be a situation like this, to fill the gap, my lord?
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. If the opportunity came my way, I do not think I would mind. However, Parliament could do the same. Thank you.
My lady, I didn't get the last part of your question. Your answer, please.
I said, however, Parliament could do the same, but if I had the opportunity, I would do it. But
I'm sure the Leader of Government Business has heard us, and the Children and Social Protection Minister has heard us, to make proposal to the executive. If it comes, I'm sure it's something that Parliament could consider. Thank you very much for that view. Now, on social rules and constitutional evolution, some have argued that exclusive maternity leave reinforces outdated gender roles, and that equal parental leave will promote shared caregiving. From a constitutional perspective, how should the law respond to such evolving social expectations?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I hear equal paternity?
What I'm saying is that there is a school of thought that exclusive maternity leave reinforces outdated gender roles, and that equal parental leave will promote shared caregiving. Now, from a constitutional perspective, you go into a constitutional court. How should the law respond to such evolving social expectations?
I think a question ago, Honorable Chair, a question ago, that the answers would fit into this. If we are to go forward and apply equal leave on both the paternity and the maternity side, we have the maternity leave already. We should then bring about the paternal leave so that it is equal. Both parents can share. Thank you.
You are giving some good news to the men. Very well. Now let's also look at balancing biological realities with equality. On this call, I would want to pick your thoughts on this. So while childbirth is biologically tied to the woman, some say that postnatal care responsibilities should be shared. How should the law balance biological differences with the constitutional imperative of gender equality?
Very well, talking about postnatal biological duties. If I were a young mother, just had a baby, I do not think that I'll leave my baby with the father of the baby to breastfeed it. Thank you.
My lady, but these days we are told that there is this machine that pumps the breast milk. So, my lady, if you have to go and preside, and the man has taken paternity leave, maybe if you, within some 4 hours, maybe these days that you can sit in the afternoon doing your case management, some 2 hours, and come back. Is it the case of my lady that you're going to strictly stay by baby girl? Is that the impression my lady is creating? Would that maybe pumping for the man to take care of that within the two hours or three?
Honorable Chair, thank you. My premise was, if I was a fresh mother and had just had a baby, I do not think, if I had just had a baby, I don't think I'll be going to the courtroom soon, and I wouldn't like to leave my fresh baby with the daddy. Okay. If the baby were 9 months, I can
That's fine.
Express milk and put down and...
Very well. Okay. All right. Now then, let's deal with international human rights commitment a bit. Our country is a party to international human rights treaties that promote gender equality, such as the CEDAW. Should these international obligations influence judicial interpretation in favor of paternity leave? In view of all the thinking so far you've put out regarding your position on such rights.
Yes, why not, so long as they bring about good practice, but then we would have to marry them into our own experiences and come out with our laws that fall within what those rights are.
So, my lady, so looking at your date of birth, should the majority eventually confirm you, how many years are you going to be on the Supreme Court bench?
6.5 years. My honorable chair, 6.5 years.
My lady. Honorable Parliament will do the approval. And we are in the process of vetting. Why do you say should majority confirm you?
I get what the chairman is saying. What I'm suggesting is that normally we take decision by majority. You know, majority carries the vote when the question is put. They say the ayes have it. The ayes have it. It can also be unanimous, yes. But looking at their behavior, look, they are yesterday's sins, I don't think. Anyway, You are a backbencher. When leaders are having their thing, you want to get yourself involved. You are just a returnee. Are you the avant-garde of government business? Only yesterday, you people had a different
Please
position.
Address the
now
chair
you have changed
to ask
inconsistent
your
people. Very proceed well. Judicial role in gender justice. My lady, if a case challenging constitutionality of laws granting maternity leave but denying paternity leave come before you, how would you approach the issue to ensure fidelity to both equality and public interest?
I will look at the laws and apply what they say. And if there's something missing, and from the point of the facts before me, I can cure any mischief or lack, I'll do so according to law.
My lady, I'm now going to focus on issues on constitutional provisions relating to the Council of States, i.e. Article 89 to 92, and the growing public calls for its abolition or reform, especially proposals to replace it with a second chamber of parliament, i.e. a Senate or a House of Elders, to strengthen deliberative governance. So my next set of questions are going to be based on these. So first would be on democratic legitimacy and constitutional design. Now, the law provides that the Council of State is an advisory body with no legislative power. Yet, it is sometimes called a toothless echo chamber. In your view, does its existence enhance or undermine democratic accountability and legitimacy within Ghana's constitutional framework?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'm not of the view that its existence undermines what you have just said. I'm the view that if we find that they lack certain strengths, those could be enhanced to make their output serve our purposes as a nation. Thank you.
Now, my lady, in the advisory role, reference is often made to decisions that they have communicated to the presidents. And the decisions are communicated without the details being shared with the public. And the public lately seem to be so concerned about the governance of our country. Would you suggest that the time has come for the Council of State to be seen to be doing some interfacing by explaining to the public or sharing with institutions like Parliament some of its decisions? After all, even in the lawmaking process, where the president refuses to assent, there's a process that requires a referral to the Council of State for them to have an opinion and bring it back to Parliament for a second consideration of the bill. This, it is stated in the Constitution. But in other matters, we don't. A recent example is the public outcry regarding their determination of a prima facie against Her Ladyship, the Chief Justice. Some hold the view that a transparent system where the Council of State, for instance, could have come out with their written opinion and share with the public on what constitutes the prima facie which led to the president exercising the discretion to suspend, that would have been helpful for governance. Would you be of that position that they should be seen to be proactive and sharing with us the views they express in advising presidential decisions or guiding presidential decisions? It could be anybody. Who knows?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I do not think that will work in every situation. There may be some things which right now here I cannot mention, which may be necessary for them to explain to the public, but I do not believe that in all things they have to come and explain to the public as an advisory body. Thank you.
Now, my lady, let's delve into comparative constitutional models. In other jurisdictions, upper houses or the Senate exist to provide mature second thought to legislative processes. Do you believe replacing Ghana's Council of State with a second chamber will better reflect the principles of representative democracy?
Honorable Chair, I do not think that will necessarily be so. Thank you.
You don't think?
My answer to the question was, I do not think that will necessarily be so. The replacement.
Very well. Can you explain? Can you justify?
Can I kindly have the question again?
Yes, very well, sure. What I'm saying is that in other jurisdictions, the upper houses or the Senate exist to provide mature second thought to legislative processes. Do you believe replacing Ghana's Council of State with a second chamber would better reflect the principles of representative democracy?
I said I necessarily, Honorable Chair, my answer is that I necessarily do not think that would be so. Coming from my earlier answer, that the Council of State could be strengthened. Thank you.
So now, let me follow up on the phrase could be strengthened. Can you share some views on ways of strengthening the Council of States to enable them meet modern expectations in governance.
Very well, Honorable Chair, thank you. I'll say that before this moment, this question had never come to me. If I am to give you a view, I'd have to sit down and critically look at the articles on the Council of State before I can come out. But I gave an example that in the advisory role, they may have to share certain things with the public, not everything. That is one thing that could strengthen good governance. Thank you.
My lady, some have held this view that Article 89 appointment in part perhaps amount to elite capture.
Next time I can help.
Reason ascribed to this include the fact that it allows the president to appoint majority of its members, and the president may exercise their discretion by perhaps yielding to some elite in society who would want to be there. Do you consider this concentration of appointment of power a threat to Council of State independence? If so, how should it be constitutionally addressed? Of course, I'm mindful of the fact that there are regional reps. Each region brings a representation, and the mode of election comes from the various assembly members. Each assembly nominates or select two persons to constitute the college to do this election. But I am the mainstay of my question is on the concentration of power in the hands of the president to choose majority. Do you think that this is a threat to the independence of the council and the constitution must be looked at, in your view?
In my view, I do not believe that it's a threat. As you said, there's regional representation. That, in my view, is a balance. Thank you.
Well, to the extent that the regional representation does not create the arithmetic balance, like I said, the majority are appointed. I am looking at the issue of the majority being appointed by the president vis-a-vis the independence of SEMA. If, as it were, the regional representation would amount to, say, 55%, or 60%, and the president's appointment is say 40%. Like we have in a number of governing councils, most of the university governing councils, they are up to like 17, 18, but the actual presidential appointment in them are four, not more. So it's in that context that I want to pick your thoughts regarding whether the constitution can help us to deal with this imbalance.
Honorable Chair, thank you. You're saying whether the Constitution as it is can help us or if amended. Because it is as it is.
Yes, obviously, I'm looking at, when I say to be constitutionally addressed, I believe you appreciate
it. I am still of the opinion that I do not think that because you're saying that most of them are appointed by the president, that is going to affect the way they carry out their constitutional duties. I do not think so.
My lady, given that the Council of State's advice is not binding and that Parliament already performs scrutiny functions, what would you say would be your views for the justification of the constitutional purpose of the Council of State?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not too long ago, you asked whether there was a need to create an upper chamber or second one to help carry out the work of
That will not just be advisory, but enhanced lawmaking.
So I am saying.
Honorable member, with all due respect, let me repeat. If a question is posed to the nominee and the nominee is in the process of answering the question, respectfully, let's allow the nominee to finish answering the question. Then you have the opportunity to ask another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember your question is, their advice is not binding. Is that it? However, I'm still asking the question. You are saying that the advice from Council of State is not binding.
However, Parliament, in the performance of its mandate of scrutiny, is able to undertake reviews and make laws. In that context, I'm trying to pick your thoughts as to whether or not there is still any constitutional relevance of the Council of State. However, you were trying to relate it to my earlier position on the need to create an upper chamber. And I was trying to draw your attention to the fact that the context I placed the upper chamber was to help enhance the process of lawmaking. They will not be there merely for advisory purpose. So I was trying to get that context captured properly so that it aids you in your answer.
Very well. Earlier on, I think I mentioned the Council of State should be strengthened to perform its duties. So I'm of the view that if now the advice is not binding, it is one of the things that could be looked at. Thank you.
Now, my lady, we have the Council of State, we have the Parliament, we have you, your institution, the court. In your very honest opinion, do you think there are still very grave deficits in terms of the checks and balances on the executive arm of government?
I hope I understood the question when you say whether there are still very great deficits. Exactly what would that mean?
Well, what I mean by deficits or gaps in the checks and balances is to mean that we've had views expressing concern about the powers of the executive, and that it appears that the check meeting of the executive is not sufficient enough. For instance, in the situation we have now, where the ruling government is having 2/3 or almost in Parliament, the view is that the check meeting, the checks, will not be as expected because they would use their majority to protect government. Same way, when it was 137-137, the public reacted quite differently, that, well, with that strong parliament where there was almost equality in numbers, the executive would be subjected to much more scrutiny. So that is the background upon which I mount the question to you, that do you think that with all of these, legislature is there, you have the Council of State, including the judiciary, there are still some gaps to be filled. And of course, I know that CSOs are also doing their best, they whistle blow and all. In spite of all of these, Ghanaians seem to have serious concerns about the governance and the exercise of executive power. Do you think there are still gaps, and what, if so, do you have some suggestions to help strengthen these to ensure some safeguards?
In my humble view, Mr. Chair, I do not think that the gray gaps, or as mentioned by the honorable member, are any deep or many. As I can see, he himself is working very hard. And the judiciary is also there. And the checks and balances within the constraints or the ambit of the Constitution are working. Thank you.
My lady, you are an Article 71 office holder.
Respectfully so,
right,
Mr. Chair.
So let me ask this. How do you reconcile the exclusive remuneration regime under Article 71 with Ghana's broader public sector pay policy, particularly the single spine salary structure? Would you suggest some amendment? Do you think that there must be some amendment to Article 71 in view of our public sector pay policy, which moves in a certain direction?
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would not suggest that there should be an amendment, but looking at the other side of the coin, where there's always a cry for better conditions, government should pay the other side better. Thank you.
The Constitutional Review Committee is doing some work. Of course, you as a judge, your job is also do your review while sitting on the bench. May I ask, should you eventually get to the bench, would you consider it within the judiciary remit to interpret or limit the scope of Article 71 to reduce disparities in compensation across public institutions? And I say so based on your earlier answer that you believe that the others who are not covered by Article 71 should be well considered by government in terms of their remuneration, that they should be paid well. Those were your words.
Kindly, Mr. Chair, so what is the current question?
The current question is that, would you consider it within the judiciary's remit to interpret or limit the scope of Article 71 to reduce disparities in compensation across public institutions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this is another way of asking me the same question. At the end of the day, I said I did not agree that the Article 71 conditions should be subject to an amendment. The other side should be improved. So why would this happen now? No.
My lady, there are public concerns that Article 71 fosters self-serving pay increment by political elites, including other beneficiaries under 71, the judiciary, cannot be taken out because you are expressly stated there. What constitutional or legal checks do you think should be imposed to prevent abuse and restore public trust? The concern has been that the committee, Mr. Bedzedi, you are not talking on record. Can you be quiet and listen?
Please.
And if you disagree.
Leader.
And if you disagree.
You are supposed to address the chair. You are supposed to address the chair. You are supposed to address the chair. So please go ahead and address the chair. Me, what I've heard is when you said abuse of Article 70, this thing rhetorically, the head, is it being abused? So this should not detract your attention from proceeding to answer the question that you have to. Yes. Your member do not even know what is happening. So just focus on your question.
My lady, let me. This is part of politics. I'm used to it, so I'm used to it. One day they will be in this chair. One day, very soon. So let them enjoy the liberties of governance and intimidate me. I will get them. They will. They
let,
would be.
Let me
minority.
Complete your prophecy by saying that after 50 years.
No problem. It's okay. We prophesied in 2016 that it will take you 50 years, and you are here. Don't worry. Don't worry. You would have to bring a new candidate in 28. We'll see. You continue enjoying and intimidating. These are precedents that tomorrow, when you are suffering, you will have no ventilation. So enjoy what you think you are doing to me. You are a returning, you are also talking so. I've forgiven you your sins. It's okay. Very well, it's okay. This is part of the politics, you know. Let's, my lady, it was just to give you some breather, so we come back. So, my lady, the question here is that there are public concerns that Article 71 fosters self-serving pay increment. Now, I want to know from you what constitutional or legal checks do you think should be imposed to prevent abuse and restore public trust? Because the public is always out against this Article 71, and I believe you hear these public outcries.
Very well. Very well, Mr. Chairman. As the Constitution stands and what provision it has made for Article 71, I believe it is within that ambit that when it is time for the emoluments or salaries or whatever underneath it to be paid, are paid. You were talking about political something earlier on, and you said judges are also there. I can only speak for judges. I will say, for good reason, the judiciary was placed under Article 71. And down the years, as compared to you were advocating for people on single spine, etc. I know others elsewhere who work and are paid single spine have their pay increments annually. It does not happen in the judiciary. We wait, as it were, 4 years passes, and we are paid those monies, which we should have been earning 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago. You and I know what happens to the economics of it. So I don't find that disbursement to the judiciary as abuse when the time comes for us to be entitled to what is our entitlement. Thank you.
My lady, it's the same thing for the political class, the MPs, the same thing. The ministers, the same thing. But it appears that the public doesn't see it in that light. It's a reason why I would follow up by asking whether you will agree that to bring certainty to this matter, if somebody on single spine receives an annual increment, there is a proper bargaining, whether minister, MP, judge, public services commission chair, judicial council, council of states, there must be a system that allows you to negotiate your wages, remuneration commission that determines year on year, so that you know that each year this is how it's going to be. Now, this thing is constitutionally guided, so you cannot touch it. In the spirit of ensuring certainty, would you suggest a judicial touch on this provision? In other words, amending Article 71, or that the Constitutional Review Committee should look at addressing this issue in Article 71.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the need arises that the Constitutional Review Committee has to look at it, I do not have a problem with that. If it has to come to the point where people have to bargain, like you said, for their salaries or entitlements, for lack of a better word, like it's done, maybe single spine annually, like you're saying. I mean, in reality, who likes taking their salary 4 years back and it doesn't have economic value? Those are all issues that could be looked at. And if there's a real need, then something could be done about it. But like you yourself said, it is part of the Constitution for now.
So, Article 71 insulates certain public office holders from salary regulation under general law, and those public office holders we already know, we need not repeat. Do you think that this provision itself violates the spirit of equality and non-discrimination as enshrined in Article 17, given the fact that others would have to be on single spine?
Very well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I am not comfortable with the word insulate. I do not think Article 71 was put into the Constitution to make anybody better off than anybody. The Constitution was promulgated by the people for the people to work for them at a certain point in time. And they thought it so. And we have it as it is. So if you say that it is discriminatory, I would not totally agree. Because for good reason, Article 71 was put in the 1992 Constitution. Thank you.
My Lord, I'm now taking you through my last set of questions, and then we are done for the day. And please bear with me. I want us to deal with some theoretical and constitutional justifications, and then ask that, you know, critics argue that the doctrine of adverse possession permits a trespasser to obtain legal title through unlawful occupation, undermining the constitutional right to property. In your view, how does the concept of adverse possession reconcile with Article 20 of the 1992 Constitution? Which guarantees protection from deprivation of property.
Joy 99.7 FM. Joy 99.7 FM.
Very well, Mr. Chairman. Adverse possession, we know that's not just happened. Certain things happen that eventually end up in adverse possession. And if that does happen, and the law says the property passes on, I do not think how that is contradictory to what the Constitution is saying. People are not denied of owning property, but if you have property and you sit by idle at the end of the day, you may lose it. Thank you.
So, my lady, it is your view that it does not run counter with Article 20 of the 1992 Constitution, which guarantees protection from depriving of property?
That's my view.
Very well. That's okay. Now, I want to know, what's your considered view regarding the continual relevance of the doctrine of adverse possession in Ghana today, especially given the growing incidence of land disputes, poor record keeping, and customary land tenure complexities?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Did you say what is the continuous what of adverse possession?
Relevance.
Considering the fact that there are disputes on
land. Considering the fact that we've had growing incidents of land disputes, poor record keeping, and customary law land tenure complexities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Adverse possession will always be adverse possession, and land disputes will always arise. At the end of the day, when parties find themselves in court, it's up to whoever to prove whether there's adverse possession or they are the owners of the land. Thank you.
My lady, can you readily share with us any case law which application of same has shaped the law on adverse possession? Do you readily? Very well. That's okay.
Joy 99.7 FM.
My lady, so we would conclude on Article 33 of the Constitution, which guarantees enforceability of fundamental human rights in the context of sexual freedom, same-sex relationship, use of sex toys, and civil partnerships. I want to pick your thoughts on this. And I have put them together to explore your views on limit and evolution of constitutional rights, particularly in the light of Ghana's dual citizen era, international human rights standards, and the growing debate around sexual autonomy, morality, and legal progressiveness. Now, on constitutionality of sexual freedom, Article 33 allows court to enforce fundamental right, even if they are not expressly stated in the Constitution. In your view, can the right to sexual autonomy or sexual orientation be interpreted as an implied constitutional right under this provision?
Respectfully, let this cap pass away from me. I believe that the Supreme Court has made some pronouncements on, if I will put it this way, people with different sexual orientations. So I would not want to comment further.
My lady, just to bring clarity, my lady, is it your case that there's a Supreme Court decision on this very matter? If I understood you correctly, because the rest of the questions will emanate from this area. So if you say...
You talked about sexual... The question mentioned something about sexual orientation.
let me put it again. Let me restate it. Is that okay?
Let me hear you again. If I can answer it, I will.
Very well. What I'm saying is that Article 33 allows courts to enforce fundamental rights even if they are not expressly stated in the Constitution. In your view, can the right to sexual autonomy or sexual orientation be interpreted as an implied constitutional right under this provision? In your view, can the right to sexual orientation or sexual autonomy be interpreted as an implied constitutional right under this provision?
If I understood the question, Honorable Chair, the same Article 33.1, in the middle of it, somewhere says, without prejudice to any action that is lawfully available. If that were to be the case, then I believe those rights. But if for now certain sexual orientations are not legally on our books or accepted, then I do not think those things could be interpreted here, sexual autonomy, et cetera, et cetera. That's my view of it. Thank you.
Yeah. My lady, I am not going into statutes. I am veering into the Constitution and saying that unless we have a disagreement of the position I've taken to the effect that Article 33 allows the court to enforce fundamental rights that are not expressly stated in the Constitution. First of all, do you agree with me on this position of the Constitution, that those that are not even expressly provided for, the courts are to provide for such rights under 33?
Very well. 33 says the person may apply to the court for redress, so I believe.
So in that context, I'm picking your thoughts as to how such rights can be interpreted as implied constitutional rights, because they are not expressly provided for. And you have agreed to the suggestion that, yes, the Constitution allows a human rights court in making a pronouncement, in your own words, that when you make the application for certain reliefs and it considers these as within your rights, it may grant that. I want to ask, under the same implied principle, can this be considered?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Honorable member, but those were not my own words. I read from the Constitution. And at the end
Lady
of the
very
day,
well. I said very well. It doesn't call for your interview. I'm agreeing with her.
You see, leader, what I want us to do is that you don't gag the nominee. Once the nominee is ready to provide an answer, it is our responsibility to listen to the answer. You may be satisfied, but others are also here. So allow my lady to provide the answer. So, my lady, you have the floor.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Yes, Mr. Chairman, the provision made reference to allows an applicant to come to court for rights which are not expressly stated there. Beyond that, what I'll say is that they may come to court. When that time comes, we'll cross that bridge. Thank you.
My lady, On the issue of on this very score, let me further ask you, how, in your view, should the court respond to arguments that criminalize same-sex relationships and say that same is inconsistent with constitutional guarantees of equality, dignity, and non-discrimination?
Honorable Chair, at this watershed point, I have no opinion or comment on that. Thank you.
Now, my lady, we are in an era of global citizenship and legal duality. On the basis of this, I would want to find out from you that given that many Ghanaians who hold dual nationality live in countries where same-sex marriage and civil partnership are lawful, how should Ghanaian law adapt, if at all, to this evolving global reality?
Joy 99.7 FM.
Well, you're still listening to Joy 99.7 FM. We've been bringing you the vetting of the Supreme Court Justice nominees. The one who's currently being vetted is Justice Ajua Patels Kujo. We make way for Geek Squad, but the program continues on the Joy News channel. Please tune in on the Joy News channel if you want to catch up with the rest of the vetting of the Supreme Court Justice nominees. Up next is Geek Squad.
Joy 99.7 FM.